the most unfriendly community I had ever known. All cold gray stone and dingy brick, ancient dampness and drabness, and a purposeful hurry and push in the streets. It evoked in me a bone-deep dislike. There was about the city a pervading indifference, a remoteness and withdrawal that seemed alien to the human spirit. She felt that English women, too, were an alien race, especially Maud's social circle. Wallace considered them suppressed and inhibited, their opinions safely submerged in a sea of small talk. She was determined to be a Yankee, standing up for the Stars and Stripes, whatever the social consequences. Accustomed to saying what was on her mind, she seemed to startle or amuse Maud's circle with her outspokenness. I was by no means prepared to accept the British advertisement that British goods were best. Nor was she prepared to repudiate her own country as she had seen other Americans do, not least her husband. When Maud gave luncheon parties to introduce Wallace into her circle and teach her the niceties of English etiquette, she discovered to her horror that this young lady wasn't for learning. Romantic novelist Barbara Cartland was a young society hostess invited to meet Maud's American sister-in-law. She remembered her as badly dressed and aggressively American. The queen of romantic fiction sniffed. She also told us rather vulgar stories, and I was shocked to the core. She hadn't changed much, if at all, when Cecil Beaton saw her for the first time. Her voice had a high, nasal twang. She was loud and brash, terribly so, and rowdy and raucous. Her squawks of laughter were like a parrot's. Reflecting on Wallace's early days in London, Ernest Simpson recalled her loathing of his adopted country. She made the error of over-protesting her Americanism. I had to quiet her down and persuade her that not everything American was best, he recalled. It was the old adage, when in Rome. Alienated from her social world, Wallace withdrew into herself, her brashness replaced by silence. Her response to questions was monosyllabic, her demeanor subdued. Even her sister-in-law was concerned, telephoning her brother to see if there was something amiss between the newly married couple. Over supper one evening, Ernest asked her what was going on. Wallace haltingly explained that she felt like she was treated as an anthropological curiosity by Maud's circle of friends. As her impulsive American ways were embarrassing his sister and their friends, she was trying to be more like the English, quiet and reserved. Ernest told her that he had married her for her American naturalness and ordered her to end the experiment in trying to be British. That evening he took her dancing to the Savoy. "We had a lovely time," she recalled. Yet her sense of isolation gnawed at her spirit. With Ernest spending long days in the office, Wallace spent her days wandering the shivering streets or visiting the sooty sights. I had many a miserable hour wondering what would become of me. She had no intimate friend, no one to chat with or take to lunch. Above all, she had no one to share gossip with. She discovered in those early months that the one topic of gossip that united all classes of society, from duke to doorman, was the British royal family. Initially, she found the fascination with the royal family baffling. That a whole nation should preoccupy itself with a single family's comings and goings, and not too exciting ones at that, seemed to me incomprehensible, she observed. In time, though, she became intrigued by the ornate and stately language employed in the court circular, the official record of royal events, which stood in stark contrast to the scurrilous chatter about the royal family that passed across dinner and bridge tables. The focus of most of the table talk was on the Prince of Wales. He was town topic number one, and in the fall of 1928 constantly in the news. What with his planned safari in Africa with his brother, the Duke of Gloucester, his visit to Egypt, and a trip to Ypres to join war veterans remembering their fallen comrades. There would soon be wild gossip about the Duke of Gloucester and his open affair with the married aviatrix Beryl Markham, whom he met in Nairobi. It amused his elder brother that for once he was not the focus of wagging tongues. Yet everyone had a story about the Prince of Wales, even Maud Carr Smiley. She never tired of telling of the day at the end of the First World War when she hosted a ball at her house in Belgrave Square, where the Prince of Wales, who was on leave from his army unit, met his first long-term lover, Frieda Dudley Ward. The lacemaker's daughter, who was married to a Liberal Member of Parliament, was the Prince's wife in all but name, encouraging, consoling, and supporting the future king. Given future events, Mrs. Carr Smiley may have regretted encouraging Wallace's interest in the royal family. Soon Wallace would have a story of her own to tell friends over cups of tea, or something stronger. In fact, she would have several tales about her encounters with the future king, real or imagined. The little girl who pointed at pictures of glamorous models in magazines and then made up stories about them now focused her vivid imagination on the Prince of Wales. During Wallace's first bitterly cold winter in London in 1928, the capital and the rest of the country were on tenterhooks about the health of King George V, who had succumbed to a serious lung infection. Such was the concern that the Prince of Wales, on safari in Africa, was summoned home to undertake his father's duties. Like everyone else, Wallace read and discussed the daily bulletins about the king's medical progress. In her memoir, she tells of the day she was being driven past St. James Palace in central London, on her way to pick up Ernest from his office in the city. She saw the scarlet-coated sentries stiffen as a black Daimler limousine raced into the street from inside the palace walls. Craning her head, Wallace caught a glimpse of a delicate, boyish face staring straight ahead. Her chauffeur turned and said in awed tones, "Madam, that was the Prince of Wales." Besides the somewhat pedantic fact that the direct route from Upper Berkeley Street, where the Simpsons had rented a house, to Ernest's office at St. Mary Axe in the city does not go anywhere near St. James Palace, Wallace conjured up a second version of the story. She told her ghostwriter, Cleveland Amory, that she was out walking one day when she saw the prince pass by in a coach adorned with what looked like a royal coat of arms and drawn by two black horses. It seems that he was making the short journey from Buckingham Palace to St. James Palace. As it was a closed coach, she did not get a good look at the prince. If the incident did occur, it may have been when the prince stood in for his sick father and represented him at a levee, a ceremony involving the presentation of male dignitaries and held at St. James Palace. So two stories, one or the other may be true, or they both may be figments of her fevered imagination. Long before she had even met the prince, it is clear that she was fascinated by him, if not infatuated. She enjoyed a much more memorable, albeit long-distance, encounter in June 1929, when she and Ernest attended the Trooping of the Colour, the time-honored exercise in pomp and pageantry to celebrate the king's official birthday. She observed him carefully as he rode on horseback from Buckingham Palace behind his father, George V. During the various military drills on Horse Guards Parade, she focused her attention exclusively on the Prince of Wales. She dreamily described the event. He sat on his horse with perfect military bearing and what seemed like the complacent calm of the whole British Empire. I found myself wondering about him not as a future king, but as a human being. I thought he had a wistful face. As the ceremony came to a close and the royal party made their way back to Buckingham Palace, Wallace thought that there must be something more, that fate would take a hand in pushing them together. She had even told Aunt Bessie that she intended to meet the Prince of Wales. Her behavior was not unlike that of other women who projected themselves into the life of the prince, some becoming so obsessed that they came to the attention of the Metropolitan Police and its plainclothes detective division, the Special Branch. In those first months, when Wallace was lonely, friendless, and had time on her hands, daydreaming about the Prince of Wales was but a pleasant diversion in a dull, cheerless round. She filled out her days with household chores and shopping, she and Ernest setting aside an evening a week to go over the accounts, carefully examining the paper ledgers supplied by the greengrocer, butcher, or fishmonger. Ernest was extremely meticulous, she recalled. He would run down the list, asking if I had had the weight of apples listed, the amount of spinach. I was seldom over budget. We lived frugally, but well. For his part, Ernest remembers that Wallace, who was, in his words, scarred by poverty, would fly into a violent rage if a bill had not been paid on time. He was used to paying quarterly or biannually. She wanted accounts paid weekly. Wallace lived in terror of inheriting her mother's spendthrift reputation. Weekends were usually well-planned outings organized by Ernest to visit a castle, a cathedral, or some other ancient monument. His choices tested her patience and her short temper. Her indifference tested his. As a result, rather than being enjoyable excursions, they became exercises in mutual incomprehension and irritation. Their mood was hardly lightened by the country inns they often stayed in. For the most part, the clientele was elderly, dinners served promptly, and silence the watchword in the communal sitting rooms. Any sound above a whisper attracted a sharp look and a harumph. Ernest, who loved history and was a fund of abstruse knowledge, could not understand why Wallace was so bored. As Wallace had little interest in Britain, particularly its glorious past, she wanted to get these visits over as soon as possible. On one occasion, after Wallace had hurried through Warwick Castle and was waiting impatiently for Ernest outside, he caught up with her and said rather petulantly, "I don't see what's the use of doing this unless you stop to look at things. You can't do a castle like that." When Wallace told him that she had seen everything, her marital didact proceeded to test her on what she should have noticed. After passing the test, she casually mentioned that she thought the interior clock was unusual. Ernest looked surprised. "What clock?" he asked. They went back inside, and there indeed was the clock, as Wallace had described it. For once, Ernest was impressed. "You certainly have a photographic mind," he said. "And," Wallace replied, "a 24-hour memory." A welcome interregnum in these outings came courtesy of Herman and Catherine Rogers. They invited the bickering newlyweds to join them for Christmas and New Year at their Riviera home. For Wallace, it was a welcome respite from the brown fog that greeted every winter dawn in bitterly cold London. More important, it gave her the chance to spend time with the other man in her life again. For the Yale man, it was the first opportunity he had had to run the rule over Harvard-educated Ernest. As for Ernest, it was a chance to finally meet the man Wallace never seemed to stop talking about. Wallace was summoned to a less welcome reunion a few weeks later when she received a cable saying that her mother had been taken seriously ill. She had suffered a thrombosis, which had affected her sight and left her bedbound. Wallace and Ernest sailed in May for Washington, where Wallace was shocked by the sight of the worn and helpless woman she had always considered indestructible. But the old Alice was not far from the surface. She asked if Wallace was wearing a brown dress. Wallace told her mother that she was, and that she had bought it in London. "Thought so," she commented dryly. "What made you choose such an unbecoming color?" It was easy to see where the Wallace bite came from. For Alice, it was her first encounter with her son-in-law. She made an extra effort to be cordial and charming, reminding him that her only daughter was like a box of explosives that needed careful handling. "There are times when I was afraid of having put too much of myself into her, too much heart and not enough head. Ernest returned to England, Wallace remaining on for a few days until the doctor and Aunt Bessie suggested that, as there had been no change in her condition, Wallace should go back to London. A few months later, she was summoned across the Atlantic again. This time she went alone as a passenger on board the Olympic, sister ship to the ill-fated Titanic. When she disembarked in New York in late October, Mary Raffray was there to meet her. Her mother was in a coma. Within hours of Wallace reaching her bedside, Alice died on November 2, 1929. At this time of grief and loss, Wallace lashed out at her husband 4,000 miles away. A day after Alice died, Ernest, who was staying at the Guards Club as the lease on their furnished house had ended, wrote a tender note to his wife. "Sweetheart, I have been thinking all day of my poor darling, and grieving for her in her sorrow hourly. I wish I were beside you. How I miss you and long for you. The days without you are a weary succession of emptiness. This must be the last time that we are parted." Her response was to accuse him of cheating on her, or at the very least, flirting with other women. In hurt but placatory tones, he replied, "Darling little sweetheart, you make me very sad when you say I have bruised our love. I am decent and loyal to the core. I have not looked sideways at anyone, nor felt the slightest desire to do so. At all times I have felt proud to belong to you and wanted to be wholly yours. Surely we can have faith in each other, you and I. One in body, one in love, one in sorrow, one in joy." It may have been the first, but it would not be the last time that Wallace, insecure and jittery, would accuse her husband of betraying her trust. Years later, Ernest, who loved writing amusing verses and declaiming Latin in the original, reflected on the letters Wallace wrote to him. Wallace's ghostwriter, Cleveland Amory, asked him, "Were they witty?" His choked response spoke volumes. Amory noted, "There was a long pause as Ernest chose his words with care. No, they weren't. They were never fond. They were never the letters of a really happy person." Then Amory asked if she was happy when she was with him. There was a slight shake of the head, a fleeting sad smile, and Ernest looked quickly away. At this unhappy time, Wallace was not only mourning her mother, but, like the rest of the world, the Simpsons were licking their wounds after the great crash of 1929, which wiped billions off the value of stocks and heralded the beginning of the Depression. While Ernest's shipping business rode out the storms for a time, it was not long before the couple were scrimping and saving. The one shaft of light in a gloomy winter was her discovery of an apartment where she could at last put down her roots. Even though money was tight, there was enough to spare so that she could redecorate and modernize No. 5 Bryanston Court, a three-bedroom apartment in Marylebone in central London. It became the love of her life. Wallace enthused about making a home for herself and her husband. It marked a genuine turning point in her life, her marriage, and her time in London. At last she felt able to give free rein to her nascent creativity. This time, she and Ernest spent their leisure time scouring London for antiques, old things they both liked. "For the first time in my life, I had the means and the opportunity to create the kind of setting I had always wanted, a place where good things out of the past would intermingle gracefully with good things of the present." With a little help from a young Dutchman called Shriver and interior designer Siri Mom, the wife of novelist Somerset, she created a comfortable and welcoming apartment. While her own bedroom was a very feminine pink, suggesting that Ernest slept elsewhere, she didn't entirely neglect Ernest's interests. In the sitting room, one wall was lined with shelves to house his treasured first editions and original manuscripts written by, among others, Charles Dickens. Taking pride of place was his favorite book, A.A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh. On the occasional tables in the sitting room, Wallace placed jade, porcelain, and her own small collection of lacquer boxes, which she had picked up during her travels in the Orient. She imported the American tradition of the cocktail hour, where her growing circle of mainly American friends dropped in for drink and conversation for an hour or so in the early evening. Unlike Ernest, she recalled, she had the knack of fixing a decent cocktail for their guests. And, in a prod at the British, she made sure that her drinks were ice cold. Word got around, and her salon attracted businessmen, journalists, politicians, lawyers, and diplomats, as well as a smattering of pretty girls. For the first time since she arrived, Wallace was beginning to find her feet, her skill as a hostess gradually blossoming, her married life developing a convivial rhythm of theater and maybe dancing, occasional suppers at the Savoy, dinner parties, and drinks interspersed with bridge or poker. In this Wodehouseian social world, she had also managed to find a gem more valuable than rubies, namely a fine Scottish cook named Mrs. Ralph, who had learned her sauces and soufflés under the watchful eye of the French chef to Lady Curzon, one of London's most notable hostesses. Jeeves would have been satisfied. Ernest certainly was. Brilliant, he called her, and had nothing but praise for her ability, as well as Wallace's penchant for Southern Chinese and French recipes. They were unusual but highly effective in drawing sincere compliments from their dinner guests. Just as he applauded her skill as a hostess, he marveled at her ability to remember the names, backgrounds, and foibles of her guests or those they met at social events. She had, he realized, a photographic memory for recalling who was seeing whom, who was divorcing whom, who was cheating on whom, who was on the up, and who was on the way down. It was an essential skill for any social climber, Wallace displaying an unerring instinct for focusing exclusively on those who were important or useful. In time, minor aristocrats and even royalty walked through her front door. The Simpsons became friendly with the second Marquess and Marchioness of Milford Haven. The Marquess was the brother of Lord Mountbatten, who, as Wallace knew instantly, was close to the Prince of Wales. If these guests were important acquaintances, then Major Mike Scanlon, at that time still a dashing bachelor who was the heir attaché at the American Embassy, came under the useful heading. He was known for giving smart parties at his small flat in Chelsea, and it was at one such gathering that Wallace and Ernest met Benjamin Thaw, who was then secretary to the embassy, and his wife, the former Consuelo Morgan. All those hours leafing through issues of Tatler and Harper's Bazaar had not gone to waste. She knew exactly who Morgan was, the older sister of twins Thelma Furness and Gloria Vanderbilt, one of whom was married to a shipping tycoon, the other briefly married to a scion of the legendary New York family. Most important, Lady Furness was apparently the new squeeze of the Prince of Wales. Wallace did the only thing she could do. Connie and I became close friends as quickly as possible, she recalled. While not as pretty as the twins, at least from what she had seen of them in magazines, Consuelo was vivacious, funny, and chic. Wallace knew that it was only a matter of time before she was introduced to Thelma, and then, who knows? She now knew a girl who knew a girl who danced, and more, with the Prince of Wales. It would soon be her turn to cut in. Chapter 7. Mission Accomplished. They were bred for sex, rich men, and marriage. From the day they were born in 1904, the twins Gloria and Thelma Morgan were treated like prize cattle or thoroughbred racehorses, cosseted, cradled, and carefully groomed. Their nanny applied white cream to their hands and arms every night before putting on white gloves in order to keep their flesh plump and alluring. They were forbidden to climb or run, lest exercise develop their muscles and make them unfeminine. In the first week of every new moon in the American legation in Barcelona, where their father, Harry Hayes Morgan, was consul, their domineering, half-Irish, half-Chilean mother, Laura Delphine Kilpatrick Morgan, would make them stand still while she cut their eyelashes. This way, according to ancient Latin superstition, they would grow up to be beautiful women with long, lustrous eyelashes. If they ever disobeyed their watchful mother, she would scream, "Twins, in the name of all that is holy, do you want to be old maids?" Her constant admonition was for them to be beautiful, charming, entertaining, but above all, to marry rich men. A rich man provided the only ladder to the social stars. In another age, they would have been bred as courtesans. In another country, they would have been trained in the arts of the geisha. Their domineering mother taught them to stay their tongues, to be decorous, and to present a pleasant face to the world, no matter how they felt inside. Her favorite saying was, "Never confide in anybody. Never tell even your pillow." As a result, Thelma grew up watchful, calculating, and hard, Gloria reckless and foolhardy. Both were skilled at seduction, be it in conversation or in the bedroom. With such a ruthlessly ambitious mother, how could they have been anything else? During the First World War, the family moved to London, a visit remembered because Thelma had a couple of teeth knocked out during a tennis game, much to her mother's anguish. And they spotted a young man darting out of St. James's Palace and climbing into a black Daimler sedan. "That's the Prince of Wales," their chaperone whispered reverentially to her flock. On a subsequent stay in New York, their mother carefully pointed out where all the rich families lived. Her obsession was with the Vanderbilts, the Royal Family of America, as she called them. By the time they were 16, the girls, known as the Magnificent Morgans, were living in their own townhouse in New York and winning bit parts in silent movies. Unfortunately, Thelma couldn't act. For that matter, nor could she boil water, make her breakfast, press a dress, or mend a glove. She left those chores to others. Striking-looking, if rather artificial and mannered, Thelma was brimming with the chutzpah of youth. When she was 17, she set up her own movie company, starring in its first and only film, Aphrodite. During this experience, she got to know producer Sam Goldwyn, and then later dated the silent screen comedian Charlie Chaplin. He was the first man Wallace Simpson and Thelma Morgan had in common. The difference was that while Wallace enjoyed a jolly luncheon with the comedian, Chaplin wanted to marry Thelma. Her mother thought Thelma was mad to even consider the notion, ordering her to return to New York. She duly married a wealthy man from a wealthy family, telephone heir James Vale Converse, known as Junior. Even though he was nearly twice her age, with the reputation as a roué, her mother considered him, or rather his bank balance, quite a catch. But he was not in the same league as the man her sister Gloria snagged. She landed a member of America's royal family. That Reggie Vanderbilt, too, was twice her age, a hopeless alcoholic and invariably impotent, mattered not. He was a Vanderbilt, with a $7.5 million fortune, which compensated for his other failings. Predictably, neither marriage lasted long. Soon the girls were on the prowl, looking for other big game. They were fascinating creatures, mysterious, seductive, and alluring. "And believe me, they knew it," recalled their dressmaker and business partner Sonia Rosenberg. "They were big-time operators, and the world was theirs." During her brief, boozy marriage to Reggie, Gloria Vanderbilt would use Sonia's dress store dressing room or her house for other assignations. She was pathetically needy, having one night or one afternoon stands for no physical or financial reward. "It was drink, 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 carouse, carouse, carouse," recalled Sonia. "Drugs, dope, men, women. Finally, I kicked her out." The older woman, though, always felt sorry for the twins, realizing that their lives had been twisted by their wicked, cruel mother. Their older sister, Consuelo, was an entirely different creature, charming, sensible, and mature. For a time, Sonia employed her as a saleswoman in her store. It was through Gloria that Sonia, a Jewish fashion designer from New York's Lower East Side, first met the Prince of Wales. She recalls that it was Gloria, not Thelma, who was the first sister to seduce the future king. He joined Gloria one summer in Biarritz, the fashionable French resort where she had rented a villa. When Sonia, who was touring the fashion houses of Paris on business, came to visit, she was introduced to the prince. He subsequently named her his Little Disraeli, a reference to Britain's first Jewish-born prime minister. At the time, she had no idea who Disraeli was or what his racial origins were. While Gloria enjoyed a brief liaison with the Prince of Wales, in the meantime, her twin had captured big game in the form of Lord Marmaduke Furness, the owner of the Furness-Withy shipping line and reputedly the second richest man in England. Like an accountant running the rule over a company, Thelma was advised about his social status and finances by her friend, socialite Beth Leary. A lover of Prince George and a walking encyclopedia of Debrett's, the Blue Blood's Bible. She was still only 21 when she married the rough-hewn widower, whose language was as colorful as his love life. Her hunting days were not over yet. Like her eventual love rival, Wallace Simpson, Thelma had a fascination with the Prince of Wales. She read the newspapers each day, principally to see where the prince was and what he was doing. On one occasion, Thelma, forthright and impulsive, bought a rail ticket to Paris when she heard that he was traveling to France. The first meeting was simple. She walked up to him in his carriage and said, "Sir, I am Lady Furness, Gloria Vanderbilt's twin sister." Another version has it that the prince sent his equerry to her railway carriage and asked her to join him for the journey. That she was on the train in the first place is testament to her resourcefulness. As Sonia Rosenberg recalled, "Those girls read the papers as a Wall Street broker might stock quotations. They followed every move of rich and important men." It is noticeable that at their first official meeting, at a ball hosted by Lord and Lady Londonderry, the prince made a beeline for the Lady Furness, suggesting a previous acquaintance. As they waltzed and talked together, she noticed his slightly guttural German accent. Given her forthright behavior and her enduring interest in the prince, it is likely that the meeting which was a prelude to their affair was not quite as fortuitous as Lady Furness made out. In her version, they met by chance in the bucolic surroundings of the Leicester Agricultural Show in June 1929, where a bored Prince of Wales was pinning rosettes onto prize cattle. Their encounter seemingly involved more planning and cunning than she has suggested. After all, she was still smarting from her husband's decision to go to the south of France with the international gold digger and sometime actress Peggy Hopkins Joyce. What better way to humble her husband than to seduce the Prince of Wales? During their conversation at the agricultural show, he asked her to dine with him the following week at York House, the London home he shared with his younger brother, Prince George. She accepted with alacrity. It marked the beginning of the end of her marriage and the start of a 5-year affair with the prince. She was not the only one on the prowl. The prince's 12-year affair with his mothering married lover, Frieda Dudley Ward, was stuttering to a close. At the height of their love affair, he had written to her 4, sometimes 5 times a day, but now he realized that Frieda, who was cultured and well-read, was drifting into the arms of a rival, Lord Pembroke's cousin, Michael Herbert. A year later, she divorced her husband for him. By then, the prince had wandered into pastures new, remaining friendly with Frieda, but spending his days and nights in the arms of Lady Furness. She remembers that love was in the air on that first royal date. The moment Thelma set eyes on the prince in the enchanted world that was York House, her heart quickened. After a cocktail, they went for dinner at the Hotel Splendide on Piccadilly, and then danced to Viennese waltzes. She later told her erstwhile ghostwriter, Helen Warden Erskine, Just he and I was all that mattered. It seemed so natural, so right. We talked of many things, surface talk, yet beneath it I knew, and he knew that this was it. For the next 5 years he came first in my life. I dined every night with him. Whatever we did together. We shared all our experiences. It was as if there had never been Duke, her husband, or any other man in my life. I was his wife in all but name. Just as the prince's gracious character contrasted with her husband's bluster, so Thelma was a soothing, somewhat bland counterpoint to the intelligent but endlessly challenging Frida. Thelma was gay and friendly and chattering, always chattering, observed dressmaker Elsa Schiaparelli. But she had no sense of wit or repartee. Both women, though, were beautiful and discreet, the prerequisite for a royal mistress. As for Thelma's husband, he was so thrilled that his wife had merited such attention from the Prince of Wales that he organized a party in his honor at the prince's favorite nightclub, the Embassy on Old Bond Street. In the world of the Prince of Wales, Thelma's husband did not exist, the future king taking it for granted that he came first. In our class in England, extramarital romances are the rule rather than the exception, recalled Thelma. Half the wives I knew were in love with men, not their husbands. During an East African safari in 1930, Thelma split her time between the prince and her husband, both men having organized these wildlife excursions independently. When Thelma was with her husband, the prince would write or cable every day, penning love letters to her, which she read by the flickering light of the campfire. When she eventually managed to join the prince's safari, their tents were placed next to each other. "This was our Eden, and we were alone in it," she wrote. "His arms about me were the only reality, his words of love my only bridge to life. Every night I felt more completely possessed by our love, carried ever more swiftly into the uncharted seas of feeling, content to let the prince chart the course, heedless of where the voyage would end." At the end of the safari, she decided to formally separate from Duke. Even though her royal affair was by now an open secret, she was spoken of as the Princess of Wales. Thelma insists that they never discussed marriage, and she never considered becoming queen. She thought it unrealistic. Not only was she a divorcee, she was a Roman Catholic, an even worse sin. Under British law, Catholics are specifically excluded from the line of succession. This did not stop society gossips suggesting that Thelma's baby boy, Tony, was fathered by the prince. It was a story that followed him for the rest of his life. Watching this developing royal romance from afar was Wallis Simpson, her blossoming friendship with Consuelo Thaw eventually giving her an entree into the social circle of Consuelo's titled and quietly infamous sister. The two women have very different recollections of their first meeting and of Wallace's subsequent encounter with the Prince of Wales. In Wallace's famous version, in early January 1931, she and Ernest Simpson were asked as guests to Borough Court, the Furness Hunting Lodge, in Leicestershire, as Thelma's sister Consuelo had to drop out at the last minute. They traveled to Melton Mowbray on the 3:20 afternoon train. Wallace, who was nursing a heavy cold, described how, in between sneezes and sniffles, she learned to dip a curtsy. Meanwhile, Consuelo's husband, Benny Thaw, gave etiquette advice, a suggestion that Consuelo found hilarious. As it was foggy, the royal party, consisting of the Prince of Wales, his younger brother Prince George, and Lady Furness, were delayed, leaving the Simpsons to nervously kill time by drinking copious cups of tea in the drawing room of Borough Court. When they finally arrived, the Simpsons were quickly introduced, the sickly Wallace rallying sufficiently to chide the Prince of Wales for his opening conversational gambit about how American visitors feel about the lack of central heating in English country houses. She retorted, "I'm sorry, sir, but you have disappointed me." "In what way?" he asked. Wallace responded feistily, "The same question is always asked of every American woman who comes to your country. I had hoped for something more original from the Prince of Wales." Lady Furness finds the conversation not just preposterous, but swears Wallace never even first met the prince at Borough Court. She argues, convincingly, that she would never have invited two strangers to spend the weekend with the Prince of Wales at her home. Not only was the prince averse to meeting people he didn't know, she had enough mutual friends to call on to make up a party. As for the conversation about radiators, Wallace's memory is so much hot air. Poppycock, Thelma said. Had this retort of Wallace's been true, it would have been in bad taste, no matter to whom addressed. To be so rude to the Prince of Wales would have been the height of bad manners. Instead, Lady Furness pinpoints an afternoon tea party at her home at 21 Grosvenor Square in central London, around Christmas time 1930, as the first time she and the prince met Wallace Simpson. According to her version, her sister Consuelo had telephoned ahead and asked if she could bring Wallace along. After she arrived, Wallace and Thelma made small talk about mutual friends and the London season. Thelma was struck by her blue eyes, which sparkled like sapphires, her large hands and her flat, toneless voice. Yet there was a charm in the attentive way she listened and humor in her comments. Consuelo was right, thought Thelma. Mrs. Simpson was fun. I did like her, she recalled. As they were chatting, the butler announced the unexpected arrival of the Prince of Wales. When he walked into the drawing room, accompanied by Thelma, he saw the chattering throng and said, "Oh, a party," in anticipation of an evening of fun and laughter. Thelma damped down his expectations. "No, darling, just a few friends. You've met all of them except an American, Mrs. Simpson, who seems to be fun. Consuelo brought her." She was introduced, and, like any woman meeting the Prince of Wales for the first time, was nervously impressed and rather tongue-tied. As she later recounted, "In our first meetings, I did not say more than 5 or 10 words to David. Most of the time, I was too awed to say anything, and instead spent my time watching him and seeing how he looked and acted and did things. I was fascinated by this." Though she may have said little, in January 1931, she was able to write to her Aunt Bessie, "Mission accomplished," a jokey reference to her previously stated ambition to meet the Prince of Wales one day. In the early spring of 1931, while the Prince of Wales and his younger brother George were on a 3-month visit to Argentina, Thelma saw her new friend frequently, sometimes more often than she wished. Thelma recalled, "She would call me up practically every day, asking, 'What are you doing? Where did you go last night? Will you lunch with me tomorrow?'" Wallace's excitement was evident in a letter to her Aunt Bessie saying that she hoped Thelma would ask them to join her at some social event involving the prince. While he had been away in Argentina, she had followed his royal progress carefully, studying photographs of him in newspapers and magazines. She concluded that he was a withdrawn and lonely spirit, and felt herself increasingly drawn to this man of mystery. Though Wallace was the social supplicant in relation to Thelma, from time to time she enjoyed a brief moment of one-upmanship. In April 1931, she invited her one-time lover Felipe Espiel, who was shortly to be made the Argentinian ambassador to Washington, to a KT, or cocktail party, at Bryanston Court. While Ernest was not thrilled to entertain his wife's former paramour, Thelma was deeply impressed, especially as she was hosting a reception the next day at her Grosvenor Square home to celebrate the prince's return from his successful visit to South America. For Thelma, it was a nice coup to be able to invite the future ambassador along. Wallace was proving to be a useful friend. As she gradually insinuated her way into the outer royal circle, little by little Wallace was building up a picture of the Prince of Wales that fell somewhere between the august language of the court circular and the chatter of the salon. She learned that the man who was born 2 years before her, on June 23, 1894, and was christened Edward Albert Christian George Andrew Patrick David, was known as David by his family and closest friends. Thelma called him P.W., a name she devised based on the first letter of Prince and Wales. She discovered that his childhood was deeply unhappy. He had been beaten by his nannies, bullied by his schoolmates at the Royal Naval College in Dartmouth, and that his tutors were invariably cruel and manipulative. The prince once regaled a party about the time he and his brothers caught frog spawn in the pond at Windsor Castle, and his mother, Queen Mary, who wanted to sack their vile French tutor, asked the cook to serve the spawn on toast and present it to him. He promptly fled the castle. Wallace discovered, too, that the prince's relationship with his father was chilly and distant. The prince and his brothers, living in fear of the man ironically dubbed Grandpa England by his doting granddaughter, Princess Elizabeth. Yet in time, it was clear that they agreed on more things than they disagreed on. Both men, for instance, had a healthy regard for Germany's coming man, Adolf Hitler. The common belief that his mother was so cold and distant that he sought a series of mother-son relationships among his paramours was, as Wallace discovered, contradicted by their warm, affectionate bond. Queen Mary had a particular soft spot for her eldest son, which meant that in her eyes he could do no wrong. As far as she was concerned, it was those who surrounded him who led him astray. Little wonder, then, that during the abdication and its aftermath, the elderly queen considered that her beloved son had been beguiled by an American sorceress. When Thelma taught him how to do petty point to stop his continual fidgeting and give him something to do with his hands, the first piece he worked on was an embroidered paperweight, which he duly presented to his mother. Queen Mary presided over the annual Christmas party for servants, and every year she opened the waltzing with her eldest son. Those watching always felt that here was a gentle and sweet relationship, a real mother and son love, recalled Thelma. The prince worshipped her and talked about her quite often, his father little. Besides his mother, he was perhaps closest to his younger brother, Prince George, who shared the royal apartments at York House. Rosy-cheeked and so tall that he stooped when he spoke to others, Prince George was the most artistic of the royal children, and the wildest. His piano playing was delicate and delightful, his private life complicated and of concern to his parents, his family, and senior courtiers. The handsome royal bachelor squired any number of unsuitable women around town. They included boogie-woogie pianist Edith Baker, socialite Betty Lawson Johnston, glamour girl Sandra Rambeau, and aristocrat Mary Montague Douglas Scott, later the Duchess of Buccleuch. However, it was his grand passion for socialite Kiki Preston, dubbed the girl with the silver syringe, that set alarm bells ringing. Not only did she encourage him to take drugs, but she and Jorge Ferrara, the bisexual son of the Argentinian ambassador, were reputedly in a drug-fueled menage with the young prince. As Thelma recalled, P.W. hated Kiki, hated her. Like all dope fiends, she tried to get others to take it, and that's what she did to Prince George. For once, the Prince of Wales took charge, effectively exiling Kiki to Switzerland and placing his brother in a nursing home, where he was weaned off his dependence on morphine and cocaine. Drugs were one thing, drink quite another. The two brothers matched each other cocktail for cocktail. The Prince of Wales's favorite during Thelma's reign was orange blossom, a mixture of gin, orange juice, and Cointreau. A normal princely night out would begin with cocktails at York House at 7:30, dinner at a restaurant, and then on to a nightclub. The Kit Kat, Quaglino's, the Embassy, and Café de Paris were favorites, the evening ending as milk bottles were landing on the capital's doorsteps. Often the party went back to York House for drinks and dancing to the gramophone. On one occasion, the Hollywood stars Fred and Adele Astaire delighted the assembled throng with some fancy footwork. For much of his adult life, the prince was a sucker for Hollywood actors and entertainers, as well as American women. Another time, the prince invited the American bandleader Paul Whiteman and his band for an impromptu late-night performance. As York House was too small to accommodate the group, they all headed for Lord Curzon's commodious but mothballed London home. His daughter Baba Curzon, future wife of the prince's equerry Fruity Metcalf, was part of the party and convinced the staff to take the covers off the furniture. The only mishap was when the rather weighty Prince Henry, the Duke of Gloucester, sat on an antique table and promptly broke it. At another supper party, given by Lady Juliet Duff, the guest of honor was the giant Italian boxer and world heavyweight champion, Primo Carnera, known as the Ambling Alp, who won a bout with the American pugilist Young Stribling, who was disqualified in the fourth round. The prince, who watched the fight at the Royal Albert Hall in November 1929, was so impressed by Carnera's physique and height, he was 6 feet 7 inches tall, that he asked him to carry his rather portly friend Lord Birkenhead around the drawing room. Even though he was a big man, in Carnera's arms he looked like a child. The results of burning the candle at both ends were obvious. Often the prince was so hungover that he would either arrive late for a public engagement or not at all, his stuttering but steadfast brother, the Duke of York, regularly stepping in for him. He was, though, keenly aware that the older generation were keeping a beady eye on his behavior and his wardrobe. One morning the king greeted him with admonition. "I hear you were not wearing gloves at the ball last night. Please see that this does not occur again." That he found the court boring and many royal duties mind-numbing did not help his standing with his father. He made no attempt to disguise his loathing of what he called princing, the daily round of public engagements where the prince was paraded before his public. It was the theme of many of his letters to Frieda Dudley Ward, expressions of undying love meshed with a forlorn sense of desolation. As early as Christmas 1919, he told Frieda that he was so, so sick of this bloody job, a theme he returned to time and again. "What I wouldn't give to chuck this P of W job," he told her in August 1927, adding, "I'm so fed up with it, you know, and don't fit in." Long before the abdication, his gripes about his role became his shtick, and he would often blurt out his disaffection to complete strangers, as on that night in Chicago with Courtney Letts. In 1927, the American Society gossip writer Elsa Maxwell was equally astonished when she happened on the prince when he was sitting alone at the bar during a party at Lady Milbank's London home. He told the garrulous American, "I don't want to be king. I wouldn't be a good one." For once, even she was lost for words. It was not just the job he hated, but the system, referring to royal engagements as stunts or camouflage, and a successful event as good propaganda. His well-worn complaint and cynicism about the institution he was destined to helm was critical during the abdication. In the time-honored tradition, royal officials, as with his mother, did not blame the prince. They complained about the malign influence of those who surrounded him. Lady Furness was firmly in the line of fire. Her American ways, her hedonism, and her indifference to any consideration that did not bear directly on her own pleasure were seen as encouraging the prince's own selfishness and self-indulgence. If Wallace ever heard these criticisms, they will have cut little ice as she listened wide-eyed to stories past and present of the prince's exploits. It stirred the Montague in her soul and made her own life seem rather dull and insipid. For a girl who loved parties and dancing, the quiet evenings spent with Ernest going through the household accounts or weekends traipsing around ancient piles had little appeal. She was achingly jealous of Thelma's life of laughter, quick wit, and quick steps. Once again she felt, as in Washington, on the outside looking in. So when Consuelo suggested that Wallace be presented at court, she realized instantly that it was her admission ticket to the world's most exclusive club, English society. As was her pattern, she gave the impression that she was extremely reluctant to go through the rigmarole and treated the whole palace palaver as a rather silly joke, agreeing to take part only at the insistence of her friends, She was not being entirely honest. The reality was quite different. In order to make her debut before the king and queen at Buckingham Palace, she was prepared to jump through all manner of time-consuming administrative hoops. In her day, divorced women could be presented only if they could show that they were the innocent party. Wallace had to be keen enough to obtain the necessary notarized legal documents from Virginia, and then present the papers to the palace authorities. That was before she could even think about the dress and all the finery needed. Fortunately, Consuelo's white satin dress fit perfectly. While Thelma let her borrow her embroidered train, the traditional three white feathers head ornamentation, and a fan. The finishing touch was an outsized costume jewelry cross to give the outfit a touch of individuality. By early June 1931, she was ready for her curtain call, along with several hundred other ladies. Like the others, she was a knot of nerves, worrying about her train, her curtsy, her headdress, and vividly aware of the stories, oh, the horror, of women fainting before the sovereign. There was even the apocryphal tale of the Prince of Wales catching a woman who had fainted and carrying her out of the ballroom in his strong arms. She remembers the presentation itself as a nerve-wracking blur. And yet, in her later account, she had the wit to remember a conversation between the Prince of Wales and his uncle, the Duke of Connaught, in which the prince commented on the terrible lighting. The prince added, "It certainly doesn't do much for the women." That night, Thelma gave a supper party and invited the Simpsons to drop in. When the Prince of Wales arrived, he congratulated Wallace and asked if she had enjoyed herself. "Yes, indeed, sir," she replied. "But the lighting in there is terrible. It certainly doesn't do much for the royal males." Once again, as at Borough Court, Wallace was all witty insouciance in the presence of the prince. Thelma has an entirely different recollection. She remembers Wallace as a woman who viewed her presentation as a matter of life and death, and when the prince arrived was still in misty-eyed raptures about the court and the pageantry. The crowning glory of a dreamy day came at the end of the evening as Ernest and Wallace were waiting for a taxi home. The prince had left before them, but when they walked outside, he was still talking to his aide, George Trotter. To their astonishment, he offered them a lift home, which they accepted with trembling alacrity. "I have never forgotten the excitement of climbing into that car," Wallace recalled, adding, "I think Ernest, if possible, was even more thrilled." The prince refused their offer of a nightcap, but it did raise Wallace's hopes that one day he would honor their humble abode by joining them for a KT. As she explained to Aunt Bessie, "You have to work up to those things gradually, and of course through Thelma." It would be 6 months before they saw the prince again. Even though she was slowly climbing the social ladder, the view did not especially intrigue her. She still found the English, for the most part, dull and uninteresting, and tended to socialize with Americans living in London. When her friend from school, Mary Raffray, came to stay for a few weeks that summer, the contrast between her guileless enthusiasm for all things British and Wallace's jaundiced opinion was vivid. Wallace warned her, for instance, that a cocktail party in Kensington would be a dreary affair, stating authoritatively that this area of London was infested with aging aunts. Actually, Wallace was misstating Edward VII's comment about Kensington Palace, that it was an aunt heap, as all his mother's female relations lived there. In fact, Mary found the occasion delightful and cordial. As she told her family, "I am completely fascinated by London. I love the look of it." She enjoyed wandering around the streets, the squares, and poking into the hidden nooks and crannies of the charismatic metropolis. When she visited Westminster Abbey in the company of Ernest Simpson, she had met a fellow Anglophile. In time, their enthusiasm for the sights of London would translate into eagerness for one another. During that sunny summer visit, Mary was not only enchanted by the city but somewhat in awe of her friend's circle of friends, briefly meeting the Prince of Wales during her stay. By now, Wallace had conjured up